This is Junk Food Cinema.
If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere.
Stop it now, turn it off.
It's up to you, Golden Corral, Golden Corral.
Stop it!
No, that's not right.
That's definitely not right.
I think I may have flubbed the last line, but it is an appropriate introduction to this week's episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Tim Curry's menacing smile. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so nice they named it twice. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he may have recently escaped from a mental institution,
and
he's a lieutenant of Megaforce in his own mind, which proves the thing I just said, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
In my own mind, I actually have a written, signed thing by the commander.
Oh, of course you do.
Giving me the rank of lieutenant.
No,
you've seen it. Don't pretend it's not there. Pretend it don't have it hanging in my fucking office.
Welcome back to the Gaslight Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury. If you would like to hear more of this gaslighting podcast, you can always find us on iTunes as well as on Blog.
Or maybe
Talkers.
You can't.
Or maybe you can't. Maybe it doesn't exist. Maybe this podcast is fake news.
Maybe you're imagining this podcast at this very moment.
I would not be surprised if that's literally what happened.
That is so you. Yeah. That is so you to imagine us in your podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the height of my ability to dream is that you and I are recording about bad movies.
Oh, I was actually, I was literally referring to the person listening to this right now.
Ooh.
Who's not really hearing this, who's really in a coma somewhere and nothing around you is really happening.
Hey, wake up. It's time to wake up.
Wake up.
This got weird. As is the things we post on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and on you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like this podcast, like it's the kind of thing that keeps you going when you're apparently in a coma, you can go to patreon.com and for as little patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, you may have guessed, and for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content no one else gets to hear. And if you pledge at the $5 an episode level or higher, you actually get access to the Deep Dish, which is an entire separate podcast, pretty much. It's a full episode of Junk Food Cinema in addition to all of the other bonus content, in addition to the things we post regular week to week, all about movies that are hard to find and worth your time to seek out, which, funny enough, kind of brings us to this week's movie.
Which we didn't realize was as hard to find at this moment, but it's a little tough to find at this moment.
This is how we're going to wrap up Gals Who Rock. Well, the movie that you would think would be easier to find given its title, Times Square.
Pammy and Nikki. They've had it with being looked after. From now on, they're going to run the show for themselves and find themselves some dreams.
All right, breathe, Mo. I'll bring your balls out.
You said bring your balls out.
Out on the street and out of the night, they have a message for the city. And they're going to be heard on Times Square.
The new iconoclast has come to save us. It's the Sleaze Sisters. It's Nikki and Pamela. Go to it, girls.
This is Nikki Marotta, famous murderer and entertainer. I'm throwing a concert tonight in Times Square. Celebrate my escape from mental illness. Don't miss it.
It's coming together.
Pammy and Nikki found each other and themselves on the streets of New York. Now, the whole city is going to share their exhilaration. The venue will be Times Square.
Well, and yeah, and given its pedigree as well, I didn't think it was going to be as tough. I know that it's been available for streaming in the past. It's just not available at this moment. There's no Blu-ray of it, but there are DVDs of it. This is, of course, a very important centerpiece to something. It's something I've wanted to talk about for a long time. This is the third film of Alan Moyle's teen angst music trilogy. We've talked about the other two, of course, Pump Up the Volume, which he made, which was his follow-up film. This film was made in 1980. His next film would be Pump Up the Volume in 1990. And then, of course, in 1995, he made Empire Records. And this is the film that bridges both of those films. There are actually shared elements that this movie has with his subsequent two movies. And it is a wonderful, wonderful time capsule of a movie that we're going to get into now.
We are going to get into, and you're absolutely right. This is, I don't know if we've ever covered a weird sort of director filmography in as complete. Now, obviously, we're not covering all of his movies, but we are covering the three movies that really define Alan Moyle as a filmmaker.
Well, because his other films, frankly, aren't that good.
Yeah.
He made a couple made-for-TV things. He made a couple movies that just didn't work. But these three movies are great. And to have three great movies in your filmography and to have three great movies that are all about the same thing but have something different to say each time and vibe as completely different movies, I think is fantastic. And these three films all involve teen angst and these teens' connection with music. And, and of course, in Pump Up the Volume, it's all about, you know, a guy who can't talk to other people, specifically not girls, but who can get on his ham radio and broadcast his thoughts on a private radio station while playing all this great music that he's brought from the East Coast that nobody in buttfuck nowhere Arizona has heard before. And then you've got, you know, Empire Records, which is all about the experience of working retail together and how you become a family and all the elements of watching the corporatization of private businesses in the 90s and the fear that of music going that same way, all of that in Empire Records. This film is a film about punk rock, where Alan Moyle came from. He came from music. He was a punk rock musician, and he came from music, and he made a movie about punk rock without ever saying the words punk rock.
Interesting. And I like that connection, too, to movies like Pump Up the Volume and Empire Records, in that music in all three of these movies is not just a garnish, it's not just a flourish to kind of represent the background of the director. What music really becomes in all three of these movies is a communication device, is a way for people to break down the barriers of social awkwardness by using music as a way to really connect with one another. And very damaged people and very iconoclastic. In fact, the word iconoclast is used in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
A very iconoclastic people able to really connect with the world around them through music. And I think that's kind of what I really love about all three of these movies in different ways. I do want to kind of briefly break down the plot of Times Square, because I want to reiterate, it's not going to be easy for you to find. I think actually after we decided to do this movie, as February hit, this movie disappeared from all streaming services, just vanished without a trace. So I looked to buy a DVD, and it was about $60 on Amazon because it's been out of print for a long time.
The U.S. version's been out of print.
So, you know, luckily our mutual friend Luke bought the British DVD of this movie. And this is sort of tantamount to a deep dish that you're hearing right now, because this is a movie that you are going to have a little bit of a struggle to find. But take it from me, take it from Cargill, this is a movie that is well worth that time and effort to track down.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was going to be a problem because, I mean, I've seen it on 35 millimeter twice. Like, it shows up every few years here in Austin and plays, and we go out and see it because we're big fans of this movie.
Well, let's be fair, though. We've also seen Skate Town USA in 35
well, yeah,
on the big
screen. Yeah, but Skate Town USA is one of those things that you kind of know you're watching something special. There's literally only one print in existence left, and it's housed here in Austin. And so they pull it out every once in a blue moon and show it. But I didn't think this was going to be like that at all, especially considering the fact that, you know, it's a Tim Curry movie and that it's Alan Moyle. I had no idea that it was going to just kind of fall through the cracks like that. But yeah, it is definitely worth searching out. It is definitely worth finding for multiple reasons. I mean, the biggest of which what I find most interesting about this movie is what a fucking time capsule it is.
Like, oh, 1,000%.
Like, we were talking about this while we were watching the movie, because you looked at me and you're, because we've talked about this several times on the podcast, is there pre-Giuliani New York is a thing all its own. There is this era of New York from the 70s into the early to mid 80s that where the city was just crumbling. The city was falling apart. The city was dirty and nasty. And what's so interesting about this movie is the nemesis in this film is the father of one of the girls. And he is a local politician who's trying to clean up Times Square. He wants to turn Times Square into, get this, a family friendly place and get rid of all of the porn theaters. And what he is pitching in this movie in 1980 is exactly what Times Square would become.
He is the progenitor Rudy Giuliani.
Yes.
He's playing Rudy Giuliani before Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah. And he is, that's actually kind of appropriate. In fact, when we first meet our protagonist, she is sitting as a prop next to her dad at a political event. And he starts telling a story as, you know, the other day my daughter came up to me and she wanted to go see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I was like, well, it's a rated R movie, but you know what? I'm a liberal. So yeah. And she's like, but when I found out what theater she wanted to go to and where it was located. And then the girl's just sitting there going, this isn't true. This isn't true. And she keeps repeating that. She's like, because all of a sudden she realizes her dad's lying to people and using her as a prop.
Right.
And she ends up freaking out and running out, which of course causes her to be taken to a mental institution for a checkup.
Now, we're going to talk about how this movie is a lot of things, how it plugs into the Alan Moyle trilogy, how it definitely shares certain characteristics with Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, because once again, I'm going to relate every movie I see for the next 6 months to Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous
because
Stains.
Because it's that good of a fucking movie.
It also has a lot in common with movies like Girl Interrupted, where, and specifically with the story that you're talking about, the storyline that you're talking about with the character of Pamela Pearl, who is institutionalized basically for being disagreeable, basically for refusing to cater to someone else's idea of what she should be. It's very similar to Winona Ryder's character in Girl Interrupted, who's basically institutionalized because she refuses to be celibate in the 1950s. Like, it's on that level of, I'm not fitting into the mold of what you think I should be, and I'm therefore a problem, and therefore I must be sick. Like, and that really kind of struck me.
Yeah.
When you're watching New York on film, there are two eras for me. There is post-Giuliani, and there is Abel Ferrara. This is entirely Abel Ferrara New York.
As fuck.
It is filthy.
It is dirty. It is nasty. They end up squatting in a crumbling building that nobody gives a shit about, so they can actually like legitimately start making kind of a neat little apartment. Like it's a really fucked up era of New York, and it's a really gross era of New York. It was kind of funny because there's a scene where they're running through the movie theater. And they cut to these two women. It's a porn theater, and they cut to these two women watching and, you know, laughing at the chase. And Hugh and Luke were just like, watching a porn movie on a Sunday, as you do. And I'm like, guys, those are hookers. That was the problem with Times Square, was they not only had porn theaters, but there were hookers in the porn theaters to hook in the theater. Like, that was like, that's literally the joke there, that it's just a couple of prostitutes hanging out waiting for John's.
Which I take exception to Giuliani having a problem with that, because I'm all in favor of public servants.
Hey, look, you know what? The M&M store that's there now is wonderful.
Oh my God. Let's talk a little bit before we get into the plot of this movie about something that always tickles me when I watch films in the Abel Ferrara era of New York, which is hard to say, the Abel Ferrara era.
The Abel Ferrara era.
Yes, exactly.
Ferrara.
If I had a couple more beers, I would not be able to say such things. I always love watching movies that take place, at least in part, on 42nd Street in New York, because looking at the marquees is like movie geek bingo.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
especially
my
here.
Lord.
Like, there's some weird things that, are they reparatory? Like, why are they showing Hard Times 5 years after it came out? I don't know, but they fucking are. By the way, you can go back and listen to our Hard Times episode.
Hey-o. I swear to God, there was on the marquee at one point, The Dark, which is a really bizarre horror film starring William Devane. that I was like, oh my God, there it is. And then there was another theater showing an entire Bruce Lee retrospective, which is interesting because the cinematographer on this film also shot The Last Dragon. So it was just funny to me to see, oh, here's another 42nd Street showing a Bruce Lee retrospective that in a few years, probably right on the edge of the Giuliani, like right at the dawn of the Giuliani era, you have a scene in a theater in 42nd Street where they're showing Bruce Lee movies. It could have been the same theater.
And 42nd Street is something that we kind of, geekdom has fetishized over the years, but Alan Moyle seems really in love with it.
Yeah.
And in love with the filth of it. Like, he doesn't cover it up. Like, he loves that about this place. Like, he wants to show the grit and raw. Like, he at this point was punk rock as fuck.
Yeah.
And just loved this nasty, dirty city. So much so, like, in fact, one of the interesting things is the band that we'll end up talking about here later in the thing, they called themselves the Sleaze Sisters. And they, at one point, they encourage girls to dress up in garbage bags that the girls start calling sleaze bags. Well, for those of you that aren't familiar, I mean, we use the term sleaze bag a lot, but sleaze bag has a very specific meaning, one that appropriately would describe the type of people who would hang out on 42nd Street at this era. But sleaze bag was actually slang for a used condom. Like, that's
really,
yes, yeah, sleaze bag literally means use condom. And so when these girls are calling themselves the Sleaze Sisters, it would be as if there was a punk band today that called themselves the Jizz Sisters. Like, this is what this is. Like, this is how dirty and nasty and raw this movie's kind of is, while also being entirely innocent. Like, that's what's so fundamentally interesting about this movie, is both of these girls are innocent. Like, they're damaged. And one girl knows a bit more about life than the other, but this is living this innocent life, this kind of happy life, this rebellious life amongst this just kind of gross, dangerous environment, and being able to handle it and then just kind of cloaking themselves in it with the name. I find really fascinating. But like, the thing is this is, for a movie that is kind of immersed in that world, the movie isn't about any of that. Like, this isn't a sex-filled, drug-filled, dangerous kind of movie like that. Like, it's literally like the most dangerous thing in the movie is when they're running from cops who busted them playing three-card Monty. It's really an endearing look at this place, and it really is a love affair with 42nd Street.
I think if any band were to open for the Jizz Sisters on a, you know, in a punk club on 42nd Street, it would be Nitro Box. So put us down for another gig right there.
With Nitro Box.
With Nitro Box. Also, the connection I have to the word sleazebag is finding out postscript that the character in Attack of the Clones who tries to sell Obi-Wan Kenobi cigarettes is called Ilan Sleazebagino.
Yeah.
Because that is Lucas at the height of his laziness.
And slipped a condom joke into a Star Wars movie.
Ilan Sleazebagino. Like, it makes my head hurt. But yeah, so going back for a second to the actual plot of Times Square, because again, I feel like there are a lot of you who aren't going to be able to watch it ahead of this podcast. You have your two female leads, Nikki Murata, played by Robin Johnson, and Pamela Pearl, played by Trini Alvarado, who meet in, very much like Girl Interrupted, in fact, meets at very different points in their sort of psychological journey at this treatment facility where, you know, Pearl is basically in there because she's a problem, and Nikki is in there also because she's a problem, but Nikki is an enormous personality. Nikki is like Vanessa Ferlito cranked to 11. She's got, like, there's something about her that kind of looks like Vanessa Ferlito. She also kind of looks like Mick Jagger, which was bothering me through the whole movie because there's a lot of Rolling Stones references, and I was wondering if that was intentional. But more than anything else,
there are a lot of Rolling Stones kids out there. Who knows? How many?
Who knows? But more than anything else, I just kept thinking to myself, this character, Robin Johnson's Nikki Murata, is exactly what I expect Susan Tyrell was like in high school, because she is off the chain. This girl is living on her own planet and she is happy there.
Oh yeah. And when they are branded as iconoclasts, it's really not them, it's her. Mm-hmm. And she really does embody the true essence of an iconoclast. Like, there's punk rock things she does that don't make a lick of goddamn sense. Like throwing used TVs off of buildings to watch them smash. Like, she just kind of starts a trend of doing that just because. Like, she is just a force of fucking nature. Everybody seems to know her. Everybody knows what she looks like. Like, she is this force that exists on 42nd Street. And she is a fascinating, fascinating character in that way.
And this is the other connection to a future movie, is that there's a lot of Good Will Hunting in this character, because she is a character who has been abandoned so many times that she can't deal. When she starts getting too close to people, she will push them away in pretty dramatic fashion. There's literally a point in this movie where I was expecting Tim Curry to have the "it's not your fault" conversation with her, because she really is kind of damaged in that same way, where if anyone gets too close, she'll push them away because she can't deal with being left again.
Yeah.
And that creates an interesting dynamic between these two characters who form this kind of incredible friendship. Like, it's a really moving, like, my favorite part of this movie is the friendship that forms between the two leads, because it's bizarre at first. It becomes very codependent and then becomes very sweet and very genuine. And you feel for both of them, and you feel that by the end of the movie, even though the two of them didn't necessarily get exactly what they wanted, you still feel like they're better off for having known each other and gone on this journey together than they were before they met. And it's just really interesting depth of storytelling going on here.
But I would also disagree. I think by the end, they do get exactly what they want. Like, you know, the daughter exposes her father and also earns her father's respect. And, you know, the other girl becomes famous, which is what she wanted. She didn't want to be forgotten.
Yeah.
That was that, you know, that's the big driving force of her. And she actually, you know, she's the girl who plays a concert on a rooftop and gets hauled off by the cops. Like, she becomes legend. Like, that's essentially that end of the movie. She becomes a legend of 42nd Street.
She doesn't want to be forgotten, but she does want to be sedated, which I just found out that for a long time, this movie is so fucking punk rock that for a long time, the only way you could actually get the Ramones' "I Want to Be Sedated" was to buy the soundtrack for this movie.
I didn't realize that.
That's really fucking cool.
Alan Moyle, all of his films have amazing fucking soundtracks.
True story.
And he was always, always tapped into what was legitimately fucking cool. Like, this soundtrack's got, you know, it's got Ramones, it's got Talking Heads, it's got just lots of great punk rock songs, but not a lot of punk rock classics, but more in the vein of all the great fucking B-sides that your cool friend that's really into punk knows and says, that's the stuff they play on the radio. Try this out. And he does that again in Pump Up the Volume. The music that Happy Harry Hardon is playing is all fucking great. And then, of course, Empire Records is just a grunge explosion. Like, it's like all the hip shit that came out in that era. And like that, all of these soundtracks are always fucking great. But yeah, that Times Square soundtrack is so fucking good.
And there's a connection to, there's a couple connections actually to Hedwig. One of which being directly that Lou Reed appears on both soundtracks, because Walk on the Wild Side is also in this movie.
Do, 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 do. Yeah, and it's used really well here. This movie's so fucking hip for its time.
Yeah,
it's so interesting. And I just now with the Happy Harry Hardon realized that the one of the many connections between these films is the characters being innocent but have self-identifying sexually, like Sleazebags and Happy Harry Hardon. That's another interesting connection. But of course, the big connection between those two films is at the part we haven't gotten to yet, which is they end up getting noticed by a shock jock, a proto shock jock of the era, played by Tim Curry.
And first of all, fuck yeah, Tim Curry. Secondly, how do they get brought to the attention of Tim Curry? Again, very much like Pump Up the Volume. It's not through their music. It's through a letter that Pearl writes to him where she is on the verge of suicide.
Yeah, she...
And he reads that letter on the air. And it reminded me... There's a scene in fucking Pump Up the Volume where Happy Harry Hardon reads a letter from a kid at his high school who's going to commit suicide.
Yeah. And it's... And he talks to her and, you know, and is talking her down and talking about how he connects with her. And it's really great. But the thing that's different about this Tim Curry character is he's not at all like, you know, our hero, Happy Harry Hardon. He's pretending to be like the shock jock, whereas this guy really is just pure shock and is using these girls to drive a narrative, to drive his own show and ratings.
Right.
And so he brings them in because he's fascinated by them. And but he also, interestingly enough, has a heart. Like, he really does start to care about these girls, even though he's been using them as fodder for his show.
Tim Curry in this movie, as you would expect from Tim Curry.
You in your head are thinking of Tim Curry as a shock jock, and that's exactly what it is. It's like, yes, there's a little smarm in there, just, you know, little flourishes of Frankenfurter. There's, you know, some definite little like comedy vibes there, like you'd see from something like Clue. Like, you see, it's like a whole gumbo of wonderful Tim Curry.
There are 8 million stories in the big city. People say I have a bird's eye view, perched up here night after night, looking right down into the heart of the beast.
And the only thing about Tim Curry is his accent's a little wobbly. In this, there's certain scenes where just the accent jumps radically. And I can't tell if that's an intentional choice that just happens between, you know, his on-air voice and his real one, or if he just kind of lost the plot during making the movie.
I'm going to go way out on a limb. Intentional choice. It's Tim Curry. Tim Curry, I would be willing to bet all of the money that I don't have that Tim Curry walked on a set every day. He would go to craft services. There was a blender. He'd put in some protein powder, a little peanut butter for flavor, a couple of raw eggs, and then enormous chunks of the scenery, and hit frappe and then proceed to gargle that scenery, because that's what he's doing in this movie. And I love him. There's a point in this movie where he dances out of a room. And let me say, I say dances, I'm saying dance only in the loosest of terms, because what the movements that his body makes, it's as if someone, whoever he was in contact with when he first landed on this planet, didn't appropriately explain the concept of dance to him, and he just went with it, because he's definitely moving rhythmically. I don't know that I can consider it dance, but it's very Tim Curry.
It's very Tim Curry.
In all of the best possible
and
ways.
And every time he's on screen, he's fucking great.
Yes.
Like, it's... and it's weird, because he's technically the top billed actor, even though he's really a supporting actor in this movie. That's like starring Tim Curry. And it's like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
Like, no, not really. But you know what? Yes. Tim Curry is the reason why you would probably pick up this movie and watch it to begin with. You know, I remember seeing a trailer for this... online and before it was playing at the Draft House, and I was like, oh shit, there's a Tim Curry movie I haven't seen. Well, let's fucking go see it. And then you go come for Tim Curry, stay for two amazing performances by these girls working out their shit in the way that Alan Moyle always has characters work out their shit.
Tim Curry does get top billing in this movie, despite his entire part being filmed. He basically shot his entire scene in like 2 days, but he was the only actor at the time who was, you know, really well known. So he's the one that got top billing. But yeah, he's a force of nature in this movie. But going back to the plot for a second, so you have these two girls who are meeting because they are roommates in this, I don't want to say asylum, it's a neurological hospital, but for all intents and purposes, it's the mental ward of a hospital. And Nikki is she's very brash. She says whatever is on her mind. She's very out there. And she meets Pamela, and she begins to admire Pamela because Pamela's very sweet. She's very poetic. She's got this artistic spirit. And Nikki takes real exception to the way that she is, that Pamela is treated by these doctors and how they keep talking to her like she's an idiot. And it just really bothers her. So Nikki orchestrates an escape from this hospital. And after she escapes, she doesn't just leave. She goes back up to her floor and busts Pamela out as well. And it's like, we're getting out of here. Like, you're coming with me. We're getting out of this place. They steal an ambulance.
Go on a crazy road race.
Yeah, where they're driving the wrong way up, which I feel like in any other city would be like on the news for weeks, but it's New York City, and it's probably the third weirdest thing that happened there that day, especially in Abel Ferreira era New York. And so they end up living at what I am 98% certain is the location of the climax of Spider-Man 2. It's that big wooden building on the wharf in New York City. I'm pretty sure it's the same fucking building where Doc Octopus and Spider-Man duke it out at the end of Spider-Man 2.
I think it might actually be the set of the big opening scene of Robot Holocaust. I think that is also a possibility.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to pause your recording and think about the fact that in all earnestness, Cargill just spoke that sentence out loud, because this is the only podcast on the internet where someone will earnestly say a sentence like, I think this is the location of the opening sequence of Robot Holocaust. Unpause.
I kind
of
love Robot Holocaust.
I know you do, and I love you for loving it, and I love that this is the kind of thing that we talk about.
Sidebar.
I'll start making the drinks.
Start making the drinks at the sidebar. How can you not love a movie in which a character is introduced as somebody who never speaks, who then 30 seconds later starts talking and won't shut the fuck up? Like, it's literally doesn't even play by its own rules in the same scenes that they set up. Like, and by the time you get to the wall of serpents, of eels that are really sock puppets,
yeah.
It's... How can you not love that? Okay, Stargrove.
No, I'm with you 1,000%. Although for me, I'm more of a Vic Morrow and flamethrowers type of apocalypse guy. So for me, it's 1990 Bronx Warriors / Escape from the Bronx. So, but I know exactly what you're talking about. So the two of them run away, and they live in this building that, you know, as we mentioned, was either the beginning of Robot Holocaust, the end of Spider-Man 2, or where Joaquin Phoenix currently lives. It is a rundown shack on the pier in New York City, and they are setting up shop. This is their home. They are living this very freewheeling sort of bohemian like lifestyle, and they're so happy.
They're stealing food. They're dumpster diving.
They are straight up. If Abel Ferreira did an adaptation of Oliver Twist, this is what it would fucking look like.
Yeah, it would be dirtier and nastier than this, but it would be the same plot, actually. Yeah, because how do they start making money? One of the girls goes to dance at a strip club, but refuses to dance naked.
Yeah.
But she's so energetic and adorable that they kind of let her do it anyway.
That she impresses the manager, who somehow, despite all reason, is not young Joe Pantoliano.
Yeah.
This feels like a role that should have been played by Joe Pantoliano.
By Joey Pants. Well, this is the era where he was still like really going big and driving buses.
This is true. So I guess if you're too early for Pantoliano, you should have got Michael Moriarty, right? Like, he's the progenitor Joe Pantoliano, right? Michael Moriarty?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go there. But the guy they get is appropriately sleazy, and kind of you believe the fact that it's like, all right, I know this girl clearly isn't 18, but I'll fucking let her dance here. And they do.
I love that it's like, so your friend says you're 18. Can you prove it? Yes. No further discussion.
Just look, and he gives her the look, and he's like, oh yeah, you're not 18. Fuck. But fuck it. You told me you were. This is this era where, by the way, strip clubs still had house bands.
I know, right? It's so amazing.
So there is literally this punk rock house band that just plays for the strippers. It's like that. It's that old of a place. And that particular strip club band becomes the band, the punk band that the that one of the girls leads, that Nikki leads.
Now, the band, correct me if I'm wrong, in the strip club is called the Blondells.
Yes.
That's the name of the band.
The Blondells.
Who end up dressing. Did you notice this at the end of the movie? Their costumes?
Oh, yes.
They looked exactly like the Pussycats from Josie and the Pussycats in the cartoon. They are wearing like...
this pink fringe.
But like it's all like leopard print or cheetah print. I'm not really sure
with
which.
With pink fringe all over it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the craziest. It's like, where the fuck did you get these costumes? It's an impromptu show and they've got costumes. It's like, you guys have been waiting for this. Like, your dream was to one day play a concert. And like, I kind of want to watch the side movie that's about this band that's stuck playing at a strip club. And then this girl ends up becoming this brilliant lead punk rock singer and is like, hey guys, you want to join me? And they're like, fuck yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Like, we're not playing in a strip club just to play. We're looking for our big break. Like, it's the craziest fucking
thing.
And
that movie would be called Blondells Have More Fun. Folks, I'm out of here. Good night.
Good
tip
night,
your wait staff. But I love that, much like Ladies and Gentlemen, the Fabulous Things, what ends up happening when Nikki is basically thrust by Pamela into leading this punk band is that people really respond to it. And not just anybody, but like young girls start adopting, like as we move forward and they go on this strange viral marketing campaign of throwing televisions off of rooftops, which, again, sidebar for just a second, we just mentioned Michael Moriarty. Given this era of New York and kind of the directors that we tend to watch who make movies in New York, were you at least half expecting, like I was, that Quetzalcoatl was going to show up and snatch them off these rooftops? Because there was a part of me that's like, y'all are hanging out on the same rooftops that were frequented by Q the Winged Serpent. You need to at least be looking up.
I wasn't thinking that, but I did have a different connection to Q the Winged Serpent, oddly enough.
You are shitting me right now.
No, because I was reminded of the fact that when they shot Q the Winged Serpent, they did the, were shooting it very run and gun. And so they'd be on the top of the Empire State Building and they would do the firing scene where they're firing up in the air and they were firing blanks, but the bullets fell off the building and were raining down on the street below and people were freaking out and thought there was a terrorist attack going on in the Empire State Building. And so I was thinking, were people freaking out because just they weren't telling anybody that, hey, by the way, we're going to throw a TV off the roof, and just they went around New York throwing TVs off the roof? Because that sounds like something punk rock Alan Moyle might actually do. So I made that connection in my head while watching it this time in particular. Like, you guys really just fucking shot it and then fucking ran, didn't you? You probably didn't even, you may not have even picked up the TV.
Hammer, you making a movie? Yes, sir. You got a permit? No, sir. We'll be back around after we go around the block. You better not be here. Real Larry Cohen stories from Fred the Hammer Williams. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm glad we each had a weird Q the Winged Serpent connection to this.
Well, because this is that same era of New York. It's the same, you know, indie filmmaker scene. It looks and feels very much the same.
Well, and it's got an authenticity because this is something else I found out in my research. Apparently, Alan Moyle got the idea for this movie because he bought a secondhand couch when he was living in New York. He bought a secondhand couch, and inside of the couch, he found a diary from a young mentally disturbed woman that featured words and drawings about her life on the streets. So, like, it's a really interesting genesis of how not only this idea for this movie, but then how that kicks off this entire trilogy is him finding this diary, which is kind of an interesting movie in and of itself. Because
usually when you buy secondhand couches in New York in this era, it comes with a dead hooker.
Or bedbugs, or both. A dead hooker with bedbugs. A dead hooker whose pimp is named Bedbug. We don't know. By the way, some stellarly dressed pimps in this movie.
Holy shit. And I guarantee you that's not costuming. I guarantee you. I guarantee you that's just people who are around that he pointed a camera. There are some serious, like, there's people in this movie you could tell are fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, are genuinely fucked up. And, you know, they're on heroin. They are tripping balls. They are, I guarantee you there, you know, several of these hookers in this movie are real fucking hookers from that era. Like, that is... This movie was desperately in love with 42nd Street, and none of it feels fake. None of it feels tacked on. It feels almost documentary like whenever he goes down there. And interestingly enough, this movie does not spend, there's not a lot of skyline shots in it. There's not a lot of, normally you have, you know, people marvel at the majesty and beauty that is the New York skyline. And this movie's like, fuck that.
Yeah.
The only shots of the city you're getting are from on top of the building where the radio station is. And everything else is on the street and it's about the street. So much so that there's a moment when we go to, we see the outside of the building that the politician lives in.
Yeah.
And it's clearly like Upper East Side, maybe Upper West Side. Like, it's really nice area, lots of trees, really pretty building. And it felt like it was from another fucking movie.
Yeah.
Like, you see that shot and it's like, it does such a great job of going, meanwhile, in a completely other world in the same city. Also, I love the fact how loud you laughed at the end of the movie, because at the end, it's got one of those filmed entirely in New York City.
It's filmed entirely in the streets of New York City. And my exact response was, you don't say.
It's like, no shit, Sherlock. It's you couldn't get away from it at all.
If literally all you knew about New York were things you heard in Frank Sinatra lyrics, you would still recognize that this was shot on location. And you're absolutely right. I love the subtle cynicism that Moyle brings to this movie, where first of all, if it wanted to be more accurate, this movie wouldn't have been called Times Square. It would have been called 42nd Street. But the reason it's not called 42nd Street is because when people think of Times Square, they think of this beautiful romantic place where everyone goes for New Year's Eve. And it's like everybody, all these tourists remember going there and standing and taking pictures. And what a, it's almost one of the wonders of the world.
It's like, where's the TGI Fridays? Where's the M&M store? Where's the giant lit up billboards?
But what it butts up against is one of the seediest places that man ever created, this side of Sodom and or Gomorrah.
It's why Times Square is so well known, because it was it was an epic cleanup project. It was about strong arming out businesses and putting a chokehold on things and massive policing, almost to a police state level. But that was the weird thing, as we've talked about Giuliani in the past, when he set out to clean up Times Square in particular, he did.
Yeah.
He succeeded. Like, the crime rate of New York went down. So the question is that I've talked about several times and I still have no answer to, is, was he right? Like, I don't like his methodology at all, but motherfucker got results and turned New York into what it is now, which is an island for the rich. Like, you can't, there's no place on New York where you could just squat.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a New York that exists anymore. That's a New York from 40 years ago.
I also love the fact that in terms of the cynicism of Alan Moyle, just like what you said, the entirety of what we see of New York is the seedy side. There's no establishing shot of a high rise in Manhattan to juxtapose. He's not fucking interested in juxtaposition.
No.
All he's interested in doing is shoving the filth in your face so much that you can almost smell those streets in this movie. And I think a big part of that is who he got to be the cinematographer on this movie, who was a guy named James A. Contner, who also did the cinematography for movies like William Friedkin's Cruising and Nighthawks with Sylvester Stallone, movies where, again, New York is not exactly painted as a beautiful, fantastical city of a concrete jungle where dreams are made up. There's nothing you can do. That's the New York that's being sold in this movie by both Alan Moyle and his cinematographer. And I think that's really cool. Conflicting, though, is who one of the producers on this movie is, because on the one hand, the pedigree of this producer is astounding, and it may have contributed to a great soundtrack that could have been Moyle himself, but it also contributed to why Alan Moyle was actually fired off this movie right before it was finished. And that is a producer by the name of Robert Stigwood. And if you're not familiar with his name, I guarantee you you're familiar with his movies, because this is a guy who at this point in time is the biggest producer of movie musicals on the goddamn planet. I am talking about Jesus Christ Superstar. I am talking about Tommy. I am talking about Saturday Night Fever. I am talking about Grease. I am also talking about movies that we have talked about, such as Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. This is a guy who literally, if you're talking about getting a big cinematic musical produced, this is the guy that you turn to. However, the clash between him and Moyle on this film is that he wanted more songs on the soundtrack. And Moyle was happy with the songs that he had and didn't want to just cram a bunch more on there to sell CDs. And that's why he was actually fired off of the movie right before it finished. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Moyle didn't even get to really finish this movie. He refused to reshoot it to add more scenes where they could add in popular songs, which is incredible when you think about the number of popular songs that are actually in this movie.
Especially when you think of his follow-up films.
Yeah.
That were just jam-packed with music.
But again,
there were tons of scenes that almost feel like they were excuses to play music, but always well done.
Exactly. And I feel like that's the difference, though. Alan Moyle always has big soundtracks. He always has a lot of popular music, but there's never an instance where you feel like the scene is constructed for the sole purpose of playing that song.
So he finished the movie, but he wouldn't do reshoots, and that's when he was fired.
Essentially, yes.
Okay.
So it's an interesting situation. He's kind of the opposite, I guess, of somebody like... I mean, I hate to throw more shade on this, but somebody like Zack Snyder, who will literally write an entire scene just to play a popular song. And I get it. Like, it's cool to pair visual language with popular music, but Alan Moyle, I feel like, strikes the right balance of, I'm going to use popular music in this movie, but only in instances where it really, really fits. And the soundtrack on this movie, like every scene of something important happening to a popular song, just like Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side, is entirely earned. It's not there just to be there. And I think that's really interesting. I also think it's interesting that the female following for the Blondells and for Nikki starts, you know, like doing what Nikki does, which is she has this makeup that she puts all around her eyes, like a almost like a raccoon mask.
It looks like a mask.
And she starts, you know, wearing the trash bags, as we mentioned. And at the finale of this movie, you have Tim Curry, hello, setting up this concert on the roof of a theater in Times Square. Actually, I'm sorry, that was more Alan Rickman. Tim Curry is more of a... it's not even really a word or a phrase. It's just a sound that he makes.
And it's a sound that plays in your head when he does that. He almost has the half smirk.
Yeah.
In this movie, and you see the lip twitch, and you're like, he's going to... No, he doesn't, but you almost, it's like, it. He almost hits that trademark smirk, but then contains it just enough to, it's a magical moment of acting.
It really is.
When you get to that moment, you'll be like, that's what Cargo was talking about. It's so Tim Curry.
Absolutely. And he was actually cast in this because of the success of Rocky Horror Picture Show. So
in New York in particular.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where it was still running.
It was probably running at one of the theaters that they walked by in this movie.
I would not doubt that.
So get out your bingo cards, because it's going to be on. It might even be the free space. Rocky Horror Picture Show, free space, right in the center of the Movie Geek bingo card walking down 42nd Street.
And speaking of 42nd Street and all those marquees, how great is that final fucking shot?
Yeah.
The final shot of this movie. So they play, you know, she plays the concert on the rooftop, and there's all these people down there, and we see just all of the chaos that she's created. And just this final shot is just kind of this crane shot as we're looking up the street and seeing all the marquees. And it is a beautiful, a wonderful time capsule of what that place was. It's so unrecognizable. Like, those of you who have never seen this Times Square before, it looks nothing like the Times Square that's there now. When I stayed in New York for several months while I was shooting Sinister, and Times Square was an area that I would always walk through when I was on my way to various, you'd go to Midtown Comics, you'd go to the Nintendo World, because those are places you go when you're in New York City. That's where I fucking go. But I would go through Times Square a lot, and man, it doesn't look anything fucking like that at all anymore. And as much as it's dirty and it's sleazy and it's raw, I still kind of love that old 42nd Street.
There is something, and I feel like it's one of those, like, I love it from afar. Like, I'm sure if I actually lived in New York at that time, I would never go there because I'd be terrified. But
no, you'd go there all the time because it's where all the good movies were
playing.
That's
true. Yeah, what a conflict.
Like, where else are you going to go to see? Because there were no video stores really at this point in 1980. You know, where the fuck were you going to see a bunch of Bruce Lee movies? Yeah, you were going to fucking go down to 42nd Street and watch them.
Yeah, no, there's no home
video. You might bitch
really
about the theater,
yeah,
but you'd fucking go.
These girls kept coming up and asking if I wanted anything. It was strange. I don't know what was going on. And we talked about the soundtrack of this movie. I just want to run down really quickly the murderer's row of amazing bands on this soundtrack. We mentioned the Ramones, for sure. We also have Talking Heads. We have Patti Smith. We have Roxy Music. We have Lou Reed, as we mentioned. Susie Quattro, The Pretenders, Gary Numan, Joe Jackson. We have The Cure, The Cars, and actually a cover of You Can't Hurry Love that I now kind of adore.
Oh, that cover of You Can't Hurry Love is great.
By D.L. Byron. Because for me, it was like the only cover I knew of You Can't Hurry Love was by Phil Collins.
Yeah.
And this just kind of blew that one out of the water.
This one is this one predates the Phil Collins.
And not only that, but there are songs performed, by Robin Johnson and the band The Blondells in this movie, one of which was apparently co-written or co-performed in credit only by David Johansen, Buster fucking Poindexter and New York Dolls David Johansen himself. Like, there is so much amazing on this soundtrack, and it's crazy to me.
Like, you expect anything less from an Alan Moyle? I mean, there's a reason why I love all three. I mean, there's many reasons I love all three of these movies, but they all come together in the fact that Alan Moyle, whenever he was talking about teen angst and music together, he made a gumbo that just fucking worked and was always just loaded with fucking great music, because the man had amazing taste in music.
Yeah, no, that's not what surprises me. What surprises me is that Stigwood would butt heads with him on adding more music to this soundtrack. Jesus fucking Christ, man.
There is some empty spots in this movie that could have used some music. It definitely doesn't have the energy of either of his other two films. Well, like, as I've talked about before, for those that haven't listened to the episodes, and by the way, I would encourage you to, because seriously, these three films, one of these days, I will host
a movie night.
Well, no, I will host all three of these movies on the big screen. It is one of my bucket list things. It's one of the last few bucket list items I have that I have not accomplished yet. I want to show all three of these movies together to an audience on 35mm.
I feel like we could make that happen. I feel like we have the right strings to pull.
Theater contact me about the possibility. I'll see if I can hold them to it. But yeah, I will show all three of these, because they're fucking great. They're all wonderful. And the thing about this, this movie in particular as well, they all ring true. They really capture what it's like to be a confused teenager. Like, the ultimate solution to Penny's problems is she just needs to be understood. She needs to be heard. She's not being paid attention to. She needs to be herself. She needs to be genuine. All of her problems vanish the minute she starts doing that. Her problems are just she's not understood. And that's something we all can identify with. That's how we all were as teenagers. It's how many of us are as adults. We just want to be understood. And this movie gets that, groks it, and serves it back up with real punk rock. Like, that's the other thing about this movie is thematically, this movie, they never say punk rock in this movie, but this movie is punk rock. It is being an iconoclast for the sake of not fitting in, not to be cool, but fitting in by not fitting in and rejecting what the mainstream is telling you and going your own way. And this entire movie's about that. And it's about people who just go their own way. And it's about having something to say. It's not about talent. It's about having, what you say. In fact, that's one of the interesting points of this movie is there is a scene in which she's breaking down. Nikki is just destroyed. She is frustrated. She's pissed. And she shows up at the radio station and demands to be put on. And Johnny, Tim Curry is like, no, we're not going to put you on. And she shatters a window and she's like, fucking put me on. And so he's like, all right, let's do it. They put her on live and she kind of talks for a second and then starts playing, but she doesn't have anything really to say. She knows she wants to say something. She's confused, but she has nothing to say. And that's where Johnny turns off the feed and just lets her go. and she kind of sings, but sings about nothing, because at that point she was a failure of punk rock. She was just trying to be heard to be heard. She didn't have anything to say. And that's the moment where you see real humanity in him, that he's not really using these girls for spectacle, that he kind of believes in what they're doing. He kind of really groks it.
Oh, I mean, the scene where he refuses to tell Pearl's father where she is.
Yeah.
And this guy's literally like trying to tear the studio apart and threatening him or Pamela's father where she is. He is like, he's standing up for them.
Penny, yeah, Pamela.
Oh, I said Pearl. That's her last name. But he tells Pamela's father, like, why don't you, instead of interrogating me on where she went when she ran away, why don't you ask yourself why she ran away in the first place? Like, he really does believe that something was ugly in her home life.
Yeah, yeah, and that comes through later. But at that point, when that happens, it's very easy to believe that he's just antagonizing the guy, because literally, the main overarching conflict is really between Johnny and Pamela's dad,
yeah.
Because Pamela's dad wants to renovate and tear down 42nd Street, and Johnny fucking loves 42nd Street. Like, he just thinks that he thinks that's where the lifeblood of New York City is.
Yeah.
And he is very kind of punk rock. He is a pro shock jock. He is a piece of shit, but but he's a piece of shit that's right where he belongs, and he wants to protect it. And he hates that this politician wants to clean it up and turn it into a theme park. And it's very interesting. It's very, this movie shares a weird thematic sisterhood with another movie we talked about way back in the day, right after we lost Bob Hoskins, The Long Good Friday, mm-hmm. in which it's one of those movies where the driving plot of the movie is about something that ended up really happening and we could actually see the results of. Like, in The Long Good Friday, this guy has this brilliant idea to kind of clean up the docks and to turn it into a financial district. And he wants to buy in and have a piece of it and own these buildings and make shit tons of money. And that's exactly what ended up fucking happening to that area of London. And that's what happened here, is a politician came in and said, we got to clean up 42nd Street and we're going to turn it into a family friendly place. And by golly, that's exactly what happened. So at the end of the movie, we kind of see the politician lose, but we know in reality he wins. And that's a really weird kind of thing. And it's really interesting because it also ties together Alan Moyle's trilogy in another thematic way, which is, these are all kind of final send-offs to things that don't exist anymore. Like, you know, that they're
Oh my God, you're right.
Yeah, because the first movie is about 42nd Street and punk rock. The second movie is about radio, local, and terrestrial radio.
Yeah, exactly.
And pirate radio stations and talking to a locality. And the third movie is about the small privately owned music store.
Yeah.
Like, holy technically shit. Those things kind of exist in a way that, you know, you still have muskets too.
This could be called the Swan Song Trilogy, where it's just like the last gasp of all these things that you don't see anymore.
Yeah, it's like I mentioned in the Empire Records review we did, where I talk about, you know, in my head canon, you know, Joe loses he wins the store at the end of Empire Records so that it can close down 5 years later because Napster comes along. Jeez, like, it's like there's these depressing real endings or to the Moyle's
very least
movies.
At the very least, Borders puts it out of business.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's there are these really depressing real life endings to these wonderful films that have great endings.
Man, think now of Alan Moyle as this like punk rock soothsayer, just predicting the ends, like really ahead of his time in his prediction of things that are going to cease to be.
Yeah, but that he perfectly collects these time capsules of these eras and does it with music and does it in a way that you have these touchstones when you listen to the soundtracks of these movies. That is exactly where the world was at that moment. Like, the punk rock is the heartbeat of 1980. Like, we think about disco and the death of disco and the rise of like new wave and shit like that was going on in 1981. This is what was really going on. This was the undercurrent.
Yeah.
Like, these bands, I guarantee you, Alan Moyle watched most, if not all, of these bands play at CBGB's. Like, I guarantee you that was a thing that fucking happened. CBGB is mentioned in a song in this movie. I was shocked that that didn't actually show up in this movie, that there wasn't a nod to it in some way. Other than its appearance in the song. But yeah, it's the, you know, the music from Pump Up the Volume is 1990. I mean, that was really what was cutting edge. That was what the hip kids were listening to and passing along to their friends. And when I say hip kids, I don't mean fucking me. Fuck you. I had Kid and Play records. I can't fucking talk.
No, you can't.
I can't. Oh, music, mainstream music from 1988 to 1991 was fucking garbage.
I wasn't just going to fade out your microphone when you said that. I was going to high top fade out your microphone. Yeah,
it was a bad, bad time, as I mentioned in last week's episode. It was not a good time for music. But the cutting edge stuff was amazing. And of course, that's the stuff where when we watch Pump Up the Volume, a lot of us were like, who the fuck is this Ice-T guy? Holy shit. Who, by the way, just turned 60.
What the fucking shit?
That's what he said. He actually tweeted about that because he's like, I wasn't supposed to make it out of my 20s. It's like, there's the truest tweet that I've ever seen in my life.
So now he's not Ice-T, he's Earl Grey tea.
He's Earl Grey.
I think he's going to have to retire the name.
He's a nice cup of tea. I'll have a cuppa. And then, of course, you know, fucking the only thing that happened, like with Empire Records. Empire Records was a movie that got dumped. They put it on 50 fucking screens and it fucking tanked. And but that soundtrack was hyped on the radio for months because it had fucking everybody. And of course, it was just like what happened with disco. The bottom just dropped out of grunge. Right when Empire Records happened, it was you know, a hot minute too late.
But
he was always all the music. That was the real pulse of what was really going on in music, and he always had his finger on it, and I'm fascinated by that.
I also want to talk about, before we wrap up, I want to talk about something else that's an undercurrent of this movie, whether you buy into it or not, is, and I want to ask, I'm just pose it as a question to you. Do you think that Pammy and Nikki are romantically involved? Because I feel like there is a way you can read this movie where the two of them are actually attracted to one another.
You can, but I don't think they are. Like, their physicality is very much of sisters. Like, they sleep next to each other, cuddled, but not cuddled the way lovers are, cuddled the way best friends are, cuddled the way you see, like, two puppies nuzzle together. Like, there's an adorable innocence to them that I don't think it has anything to do with love. They don't seem to, that's the weird thing about them, is they don't seem to notice the slums and grime around them. Like, they literally work in a strip club, but it's not a strip club when they're there.
They're like, having the time of their lives.
Yeah. They're just having fun, and they're not, you know, they're entirely unaffected by it. I don't think this has anything to do with romance. I could see how you could read that.
Well, the scene specifically that I'm thinking of is there's the scene where Tim Curry comes over and he and Pam are kind of getting chummy, and you see Nikki make an excuse to leave and literally just kind of waits outside and gets drunk and then comes back in, and the confrontation seems, there's one of two ways you can read it. It can be the confrontation of a jealous lover, because Tim Curry is getting too close to Pam, or it could just be read as what we said before, with Nikki kind of being damaged by that whole thing of people abandoning her, and she's just afraid that if Tim Curry, who, by the way, when he walks in, says something to the effect of "raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, I've brought vodka," and then Pam says, "I'm sorry, the place is a mess," and he goes, "Yes, that seems to be the point." It's like, Jesus Christ. Like, I love every moment that Tim Curry is on screen in this movie.
Yeah, he's kind of everything.
But you could also read this scene as all it is, you know, Nikki has been abandoned so many times before that she sees them building a relationship and assumes that they're just going to leave her. Yeah. But what I find interesting is that there were apparently several scenes that suggested a lesbian relationship between Nikki and Pamela that were cut from the final finished version of the film.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, yeah, I feel like they decided not to go that way, but I feel like
I could tell you why they wouldn't go that way in 1980.
Oh, no, I completely understand why they wouldn't, but what I'm saying is obviously there are seeds somewhere in this movie of that relationship going that way, because things went to that place in one cut of this movie that was excised. So
that's interesting. Right? I never knew about that. That's fascinating. Like, it's that era. That was really, it's interesting because in that era, a lot of filmmakers got very interested in exploring LGBT issues.
Well, look at the movie,
putting it out in the open, but it wasn't out in the open in the mainstream yet, and people were afraid of it. It wouldn't be till just 2 years later in 1982 when there would be a spate of them, that there were just a bunch of them that came out just all in that year. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, hey, we're done talking about how divorce breaks up family, and now we're talking about homosexuality.
And I feel like you're right, and I feel like in 1980 was when they hadn't quite, the interest was there, the way to approach it had not really been cemented yet, because we just talked about how this cinematographer also shot William Friedkin's Cruising the same year. Cruising is a very problematic movie.
It's a very problematic
because movie. Friedkin is interested in that world, but he does not have the sensibility to approach it with respect. Like, it's very, like, it's not a movie I can really recommend to people because it is so dated in its views on that. It sees, you know, LGBTQ as underground, and underground is the word that it underlines several times, and it just goes to the darkest possible connotations of that word. And I feel like that, yeah, you're absolutely right. 1980 just proved in a movie like Cruisin' that it wasn't ready to handle. And then, of course, the other big gay movie of 1980, Can't Stop the Music, refuses to acknowledge the fact that its leads are very clearly homosexual.
Except, well, it refuses to admit that, and yet at the same time, that was also part of their shtick. It was very weird because the lead singer was straight and wanted his girlfriend in the movie and wanted people to know that he was straight, and they literally wouldn't allow that to happen. That's why he was replaced in the movie. They would not allow that to happen because they wanted to continue to present the image that they were gay. So they were gay, but we didn't say they were gay. Like, that, it was a very weird time. Like, the
You know what?
Homosexuality was restricted to the discos, and like, yeah we know what happens there, but that's there.
Exactly. But what you just described in one single movie illustrates how confused 1980 was about gay culture. So it doesn't surprise me that probably at the 11th hour, they decided to kind of scrap that storyline entirely. And what ends up happening is you can read it either way, and it works either way. And there is a sweetness and a genuineness to it either way that really makes this movie endearing and really makes you want to root for both characters. And the music that they play, much like in Ladies and Gentlemen, the Fabulous Stains, is really good. There's a song in this movie that we definitely will not be able to sing any of the lyrics from because it is not currently 1980 and we can't say some of the words that they say.
Oh boy, that punk rock song.
But let's just say that there was a moment that made me laugh heartily when they're singing that song. These two 16-year-old girls are singing this song with those words, and they hit on one of those offensive words right as the black delivery guy walks in the room.
Yeah, they drop that. They have a word that it's the other F word, the N word, and a couple other racial epithets. I'm trying to think what the
with the intention of basically saying that this is how the world views all of these groups, and we are among these groups.
Oh, and they added psycho. Yeah,
they added psycho and bum.
Yeah,
as so, and then the big pull of the song is, well, your daughter is one, and so it's definitely trying to. It's trying to offend you, because the idea is that it's offending you by assigning themselves with the people that offend you because you're so fucking straight-laced that you can't deal with anybody who's not like you.
It's punk rock as fuck.
However, it's because of the nature of the song, not something that, you know, we can even repeat the lyrics, but I do love that moment when the black delivery driver comes in and just has this look on his face like, the fuck is going on in here? Should I leave? What's happening right now?
I kind of feel like with this added new element that you mentioned, it's interesting that Madness wasn't on this, you know, on this soundtrack.
Yeah.
Because they have a famous song, New York's All Right If You Love If You Like Homosexuals, that they famously played on the Donald Pleasance episode of Saturday Night Live. If you've never seen that episode is very worth tracking down.
Stop fucking everything. Stop it all.
Yes.
Are you telling me Donald Pleasance hosted Saturday Night Live?
And Madness was the band. So he's introducing the band Madness, and literally like six of their fans come out of the audience to like headbang in front of the stage while the rest of the audience is sitting there with their hands folded in their lap because they have no idea what to do with this. But they actually play the song, the lyric that they played live was New York is all right if you like saxophones, because they wouldn't let them say homosexual on television on Saturday Night Live back in 1982, I think that year is.
Until but- I see this episode of Saturday Night Live, there is no podcast, there is no life, there is nothing else on this planet until I track down and watch this episode of Saturday Night Live hosted by Donald Pleasance. It was.
And now you've got me making me think it was a fever dream.
Are you Bernstein Berning me right now? Is that what you're doing?
I don't think
Are you
so.
Shazamming me? Is this you fucking Shazamming me right now? God damn it, Cargill.
You remember the whole gaslighting thing?
Yeah. That's right.
From the beginning of the. I am absolutely correct. I am 100% correct. I am remembering that properly.
It's not fake news.
It is not fake news.
Oh, my God.
It is Donald Pleasance on Saturday Night Live.
I did this monologue.
But that song, that song feels like it should have been in the soundtrack here. Maybe it just came out a little too late.
Could be.
But it was. That is an interesting angle that I had not considered. I saw it. I've seen it every time I've watched the movie where they're, and for half a second I go, are they? No, they're not. They're just friends.
So we've got,
it's interesting that they actually shot some.
Yeah. So we've got, you know, a girl punk band who starts a movement among other sort of girls who feel like they're outsiders who rally behind her. We've got elements of Iconoclast playing these tiny little clubs, Lou Reed songs, and we've even got leopard and cheetah print clothing. This brings our entire Gals Who Rock series to such a perfect full circle close. I am so happy that we're wrapping up this month with Times Square.
And yeah, it's now you see why these movies have all lived in my head together.
Oh yeah.
Like now that those of you who have watched all these films and listened to all these podcasts, these four movies live in this special corner of my brain and I've wanted to cover them all. And then I was like, oh, I could cover this and I could cover this. And oh, hey, it's themed. But yeah, these movies all share DNA and these movies, I love them all. Like it was, I thank you, Brian, for indulging me with this month. This has actually been one of my favorite series we've done, into God, it's almost March.
Yeah.
We're almost into season five, I think.
Crazy, right?
Like we've done almost four full years of this.
Yeah. It's so nuts. It's almost as crazy as anything that comes out of Tim Curry's mouth in this movie. And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which I got nothing. I'm just going to say it right now. I'll let you take the lead on this
one. Dude, this movie, as New York as this movie is, dude, a New York hot dog, a street dog. Like this is street dog.
Street dog.
A street dog with kraut and mustard. It's, you know, that's what this movie is. This movie is unpretentious. It's nothing that it doesn't pretend to be. It's a whole bunch of elements ground up and put together. And yeah, it's done better elsewhere. I mean, this is my least favorite of the three Moyle films. And yeah, I still love the shit out of it. But, you know, I think Pump Up the Volume is a perfectly executed film. I think the standard theatrical edit of Empire Records is the most fun of these. This one, though, I think has the most to say.
Yeah.
And being only Moyle's second film, it's not as perfectly executed as what he would make 10 years later. That said, I think this is a street dog of a movie. Like this is just an unpretentious, delicious dog that you buy for $3 on the street corner.
You know, what's crazy about that is those hot dogs are so delicious, despite the fact that they're boiled. And what I'm confident is the bilge water from a New York City garbage barge. And yet they taste so good.
They really kind of do. I'm not a hot dog fan, but I was like, I can't not live in New York for a couple months and not eat a hot dog at least once.
No. You'd be stoned at the very least. You've driven out of town, but definitely stoned for sure. And that's going to do it for this week's episode. I hope you will track down and watch yourself Times Square, because it is a great kickoff to the Alan Moyle trilogy, and all three of those movies need to be watched together. Kind of like all four of the movies we've covered this month need to kind of... You have got an assignment. You've got basically a septuplet of movies that
you've
you need to watch
six
now.
Six great movies that are all about music.
Oh, you're right. And, sextuplet. Excuse me.
And have a lot of great... you know what? Something else we did not mention. Alan Moyle's movies all feature really great female characters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, he has really great, interesting, three-dimensional female characters in all of his movies. That is a hallmark of all of these films.
I agree with you 1,000%. And a hallmark of junk food cinema is that we form interesting band names. We go to the sidebar. We bring ourselves back with a little game we call Stargrove. And if you want to be in on that, if you want to see the genesis of the junk food cinema trilogy that's been going on for now 4 years, you can go on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio and find our entire back catalog. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, if you really like this podcast, if you like it more than Alan Moyle is in love with things that are about to be no more, go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and kick some shekels into the hat so that, unlike the subject matter of an Alan Moyle film, we can continue to be here. So please help us stick around longer than 42nd Street or independently owned record stores or terrestrial radio. Like, we want to stick around, guys. So patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at MassaWyrm, MassaWyrm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic.
Oh, and news, I can, it's actually like out there in the wild now.
News.
I have a new book coming out.
Do you?
It drops here in the United States on June 12th. It's called We Are Where the Nightmares Go. It is 10 tales of the macabre, one of which is a new Colby Stevens novella. So if you liked Dreams and Shadows and Queen of the Dark Things, there's another Colby story for you. And 9 other stories, which include things like haunted places, other dimensions, killer clowns, zombie dinosaurs. You know, shit gets crazy. It is junk foody as fuck. So nice. You can pre-order that now wherever you buy books.
Do that, Junkions. Do it. And that's going to bring to close this episode of Junk Food Cinema, the podcast that we hope week to week brains your blows out.